This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Andy Serkis, has appeared in more than 30 films, but you wouldn't recognize him in some of his most celebrated roles. When he played King Kong in the 2005 remake and the tormented creature Gollum in the Lord of the Rings series, he appeared not as himself, but as a computer-generated image. Those roles involved a technique known as performance capture, in which an actor performs in a skin-tight suit with special markers, allowing cameras to capture his body movements and facial expressions. Computer graphic images are then imposed on the movements to transform the actor into a 25-foot ape or some other creature on film. Serkis stars in a performance capture role in the new film, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, with James Franco and John Lithgow. Serkis plays a chimp named Caesar, who gets a drug that enhances his intelligence and is raised in a human home. He's eventually sent to an animal refuge, where he organizes an ape rebellion. Andy Serkis spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Andy Serkis, welcome to Fresh Air. In this film, you take a leading role with no dialogue, and you play the ape as an infant, right?
I play Caesar all the way from a toddler. There's a couple of shots right at the beginning of the movie which shows him literally just after he's been born, 1 or 2 days old. I play him from toddlerhood all the way through to this highly developed male who leads the revolution.
So tell us how you prepared.
Well, when you take on a role like this, obviously, Caesar is a chimpanzee, and so there's the first stage of the process is really working on the ape and primate research and researching as much as you can and watching a lot of footage and spending time with apes and finding touchstone characters. In all of the footage that you watch, there are ones that kind of pop out. You know, there are certain ones that you kind of feel are going to inspire you more than others, because, of course, there are so many different personalities in all of these apes. They're 97% genetically the same as us. It's like observing human beings and saying, well, I'm going to play Caesar kind of with an amalgamation of that person and that person. So I actually came across a real chimpanzee called Oliver, who in the 1970s became a bit of a phenomenon, and a documentary series was made about him. He was known as the Humanzee, and Oliver was extraordinary in the sense that he walked bipedally and was brought up by human beings and treated very much like a member of the household, and looked and behaved and had facial expressions that really, if one was to project, or one could imagine that was close to human behavior. So he was a touchstone character. Of course, that's the first stage of building a character like this.
What you see with this character Caesar is he grows up as a human kid, and then at some point realizes that he isn't. There's a moment when he goes outside, they have to take him on a leash, and he suddenly realizes, wait a minute, I'm a kid, but they've got me around with a leash like a dog. You want to talk a little bit about sort of some of the emotions you see Caesar going through there and how you got to them and portrayed them?
Yeah, it's a really significant moment in the piece where Caesar begins to have this growing self-awareness. And the scene that happens after the one that you're describing really is the pivotal moment where, he gets led back and he has this encounter with the dog, and he then feels around his neck and realizes he has this choker around his neck. And when he's taken back to the car and he's being taken home, and normally he gets into the trunk of the car, he stops and he looks at Will and freezes, and this something in him realizes this is no longer right, and he moves over and gets into the passenger seat of the car. And it's a really significant silent moment of filmmaking which was completely improvised and in the moment, and that's that is a prime example of Caesar and his emotional development. And so I was just living through that moment as an actor and believing this is what was right and felt right for that moment.
So you're saying you were filming that scene, you're there covered in a Lycra suit, I guess, with these markers all over your face and a camera in front of you to capture this motion, which will later be reproduced with the animation. And you're interacting with the actors and you say, I'm not going to get in the back of the car.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the same way that I would if I was in a costume and doing the same thing. The process of performance capture really is transparent now. You know, we're not having to shoot in special areas where the performance capture cameras are all around. Those performance capture cameras are brought out into the open, outside of the studio lot, you know, and you can shoot on any location. And while they're rolling, while the performance capture cameras are rolling, the live action cameras are rolling, and so everything is filmed in one hit. And there's that enables you to completely emotionally connect with your fellow actors and completely play the scene in entirety, and it will have an emotional resonance and a reality and a connectiveness that you couldn't possibly get if two actors were working in separate volumes.
You, of course, you have this role, and you also played King Kong in the 2005 remake there, where you had to, in effect, express this emotional relationship between a 25-foot ape and Naomi Watts. And you're known for very rigorous preparation for your roles. And I'm wondering kind of what it does to your head to be in the mentality of an ape for weeks or months at a time.
I mean, certainly physically, it takes its toll. After Kong, my knuckles have never really recovered, because I had to wear you know, every single day I had to wear very, very heavy weights on my forearms and around my hips and around my ankles to get the sense of size and scale of the movement of the character. And you know, it's, Kong as a character is a very, very obviously a completely different a challenge. He's a lonely, very desperately lonely kind of psychotic hobo, basically, who is past his prime. He's like a boxer who's taken that many hits. He every day is about survival, and the only beings he comes into contact with are ones that are trying to kill him and take him down. He knows he's the last of his species, and so when he actually is confronted with this other warm and non-threatening being, that he begins to feel a set of emotions that he probably hasn't ever felt since childhood. And from then this relationship develops, and he begins to and really the key turning point for Kong was a realization that he had a sense of humor, because he begins to enjoy her. There's a scene where Naomi Watts, which she played brilliantly, performs. Basically, she's performing to save her life, and Kong finds it amusing, and it's something that he's never encountered before. So that was another very challenging physical and emotionally connective role. It does leave you, it does, there's always a decompression period after playing any role that I get into, because I take it very seriously. And emotionally, you're tricking your mind and body into these situations. You know, you are telling your body that you are this thing and that you're feeling these thoughts and that you are experiencing these experiences. So it does always take time to kind of to come out the other end.
You didn't go home and stand on the dining room table and beat your chest in front of your wife and children.
I'm sure she'd say that I did, actually. It's funny, because my wife and my children, whenever they watch the roles that I've been involved with, they my children have witnessed me shooting all of these, from Gollum through Kong through, through Caesar to Captain Haddock and Tintin. My children can see a direct correlation. People ask me, do you recognize yourself on the screen once these are, when the digital makeup in effect is overlaid on top of your performance? And I say, yes, of course, I recognize every single twitch, every single every single thought process and acting decision and choice. And my wife and children absolutely do. They look up on screen and they see me in those roles. It's quite extraordinary, really.
Well, we have to talk about Gollum, your portrayal of the creature in the Lord of the Rings films. This is really an amazing effect. And since not everyone's seen it and it's been a few years, why don't you just, first of all, describe Gollum physically and remind us of sort of how he became the creature he was in the story?
Gollum used to be a hobbit called Smeagol, and he was one of a clan that lived by a river. And he comes across the ring via his cousin, who discovers it when they're fishing one day, and he falls into the river and trying to catch a big fish, and Deagle, his cousin, comes across this shining object at the bottom of a lake and brings it up. And the moment that Smeagol, who is kind of known as a bit of a sneak in his village, I mean, he's not like a really terrible villain or anything, but he's a bit sneaky as a human, as a hobbit rather. And he then, immediately he lays eyes on it, becomes craven and lustful towards it, and cannot take his eyes off it, and to the point where he fights his cousin and kills him and throttles him. He then over a number of years, is kind of cast out into the wilderness and begins to physically, mentally depreciate and become riddled and scarred mentally and physically, and curl and twist and get knotted up as if this virulent kind of physical disease was overtaking him. And it's the effect of the ring and the craven lustfulness of the ring overpowering him. And he turns into Gollum, and he can't bear to be in view of the sunlight. It's too, it almost exposes him to the guilt of him killing his cousin. And he crawls into the middle of what's an area known as the Misty Mountains and hides himself underground for nearly 500 years and gradually turns mad. And he begins to talk to himself, and you know, the two sides of his personality are at war with each other. This Smeagol, the innocent sort of side of himself, and Gollum, the more aggressive, manipulative. And there's a constant sort of battle between himself.
And describe him physically, what his face looks like, what his body looks like.
He's very gnarled and very thin, he's emaciated, he has a few strands of hair, he's got scars all down his back, he's got a handful of teeth and huge kind of luminous bulbous eyes. You know, he's a wreck. You know, his skin is pallid, and his skin is almost scaly and chafed and worn, and you know, he's pretty much a pretty ugly little gnomic like character.
Right. An amazing thing to behold. And now let's listen to the voice. This is a scene from the second Lord of the Rings film, and here Gollum is the two sides of his personality are arguing with one another. They're obsessed with the ring that is, of course, at the center of the story, which he refers to as precious, and he's here arguing with his darker self about whether to turn against Frodo Baggins, who he refers to as his master. Let's listen.
Yes, precious. False. They will cheat you, hurt you, lie. Master's my friend. You don't have any friends. Nobody likes you.
Not listening. Not listening.
You're a liar. And a
no.
Murderer. Go away. Go away!
And that's our guest Andy Serkis playing Gollum in The Lord of the Rings. Tell us about getting the voice. Is your voice enhanced in any way, or is that just you?
No, that's just my voice.
Wow.
And the voice was created through trying to find, you know, I'm not like a voice actor per se. I don't just do voices. It only comes through character and through acting. And for me, it's linked entirely to physicality and through, you know, centering an emotion around a voice. So Gollum, you know, as I described earlier, he feels very guilty about murdering his cousin, and a lot of his guilt is trapped in his throat. And he's called Gollum. Tolkien calls him Gollum because of the way he sounds. So I had to find a voice that sounded like someone Gollum-ing. You know, this the ring is overpowering him, and I wanted this sense that his body was controlled by it. So there was an involuntary action that was making him sound like this. And I looked to one of my cats, actually, Diz, who sadly isn't around anymore. But he came in while I was kind of working on the character one day and coughed up a fur ball. And this became really interesting to me because, you know, you watch a cat throwing up a fur ball, and it's like the whole body sort of writhes from the tip of the neck to the tip of the tail and sort of, you know, convulses. And you see this ripple going down its spine. And then this sound kind of happens where it kind of comes into the throat, and you see this fur about to being chucked up, and then they sort of go, which suddenly became, and that's how the sound happened.
Oh my heavens! It must have been fun living with you while you were getting that right.
Absolutely. Yeah, my kids were, you know, I mean, they're over it now, but you know, I used to, if they wouldn't go to bed, it was a great way of getting them to bed.
Now, maybe this would be a good moment to talk about, you know, performance capture technology and how it's changed, because I gather when you did that role, Gollum, it's different than in the current film, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's more sophisticated. Kind of give us the basics and tell us how you did Gollum and how that was translated into the screen.
Well, much the same way. I mean, Peter Jackson wanted an actor to play the role. I mean, traditionally, visual effects, you know, the alternative was to have an animated character of Gollum appear on the screen. Now, if that was the case, you would have had represented on the set a tennis ball on a stick, and the other actors, i.e. Elijah Wood and Sean Astin, would have had to pretend that Gollum was there, and they'd have to pretend that they knew what he was feeling or thinking, or you know, what he was saying to them, and someone would read the lines off, and that would be it. And then you know, months down the line, you know, animators would keyframe animate, and that character would be placed into the scene. Peter Jackson, one of the things he wanted to do, he said when I first met him, you know, it's insane that Gollum drives all of these scenes. He's the protagonist in so many of these scenes. The thought of him not being there, present on set, is ridiculous. We need to have an actor who can play the role and act with the other actors and interact. So there were two methods, really, that we shot Gollum. And, you know, I acted on set with the other actors, much like I did on Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And then my performance was either rotoscoped, which means if there was close interaction, I was grabbing Frodo's cloak, for instance, they would paint frame by frame over my hand grabbing the cloak. So you had that definite interaction. But then I also was able to go and shoot on a motion capture stage with all the cameras and me wearing the motion capture suit with markers on. And I would be driving the digital image of Gollum, but it was entirely shot separately. So I had to having emotionally lived through the scenes with Sean and Elijah, I then had to recreate those scenes on my own and just remember what we did on the day of filming. So there was a slight disconnect to what we were doing. The facial capture of Gollum was created by the design of the character was created around my muscle structure in my face, so that the animators could then, my performance was filmed on 35mm, and then the animators copied it frame by frame. So all of my twitches, my eye movements, my expressions, my mouth, and so on were literally frame by frame matched and overlaid with pixels. Now, the development that has taken place over the last decade has enabled, for one, you know, on King Kong, for instance, it then moved to facial performance capture, where I was literally, in the same way that I'd worn markers on my suit, I'm now wearing markers on my face, like 132 tiny little markers which go around my eyelids and track my eye movements, and each facial expression that Kong pulls is driven directly from my muscles on my face.
And you're surrounded by cameras which follow those markers and then make and integrate.
Absolutely.
Them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now with you know, performance capture then took a big leap and took center stage in films like obviously Avatar and now Rise of the Apes and Tintin, where you've got virtual production where the whole shoot is basically taking place in a motion capture studio, and you have multiple actors acting with each other using this technique. With Rise of the Planet of the Apes, this is the first time we're moving out of a motion capture studio and into the real world, where both the actor is being filmed using film camera and the performance capture actor is being filmed using the performance capture camera, so that, as I say, they're both intrinsically linked in the moment.
Now, in Gollum, you do the movements, and he has a very, very kind of pouncy, animalistic way of moving, and you scramble up hillsides, romp through marshes, get whacked around. You're doing all of that, and it's all being captured, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's on set, on the live-action sets, this is the difference. When I played Gollum in Lord of the Rings, if I was climbing up the side of a mountain, which I physically did, you know, I was on every single location, swimming through streams, all of that, that wasn't captured. That was filmed on 35mm, and okay, for certain of those shots, it was rotoscoped and painted over. But obviously, I did all the movement for it. Now, this is the difference. If I was doing that now, in fact, when we've been shooting on The Hobbit, which is where I reprise my role of Gollum, we've just shot all of Gollum's scenes, and I was able to do exactly that, but it was performance captured on the live-action set.
Now, there was a debate about whether you should have gotten an Oscar nomination for Gollum. Modesty aside, what do you think about the arguments for recognizing a performance capture role like this and giving it kind of all of the recognition that other actors get with the Academy?
I mean, my take on it is, and having worked in it for some years now, is that acting is acting. A performance is a performance. When we shoot these scenes, after they've been shot, the director, Rupert Wyatt, then cuts the film. He edits the film. And the actor's performance, my performance as Caesar, for instance, in this film, you know, he can see my face on film going through all the emotions. He then cuts the entire story using my performance. And then 8 or 9 months down the line, the visual effects shots, the overlaying of the performance with the skin and the texturing and the colouring and the eye, you know, the painting over my eye movements and so on, that's done later on. But the director's already edited the movie and told the story and wants to uphold the performance of that actor.
I do sometimes wonder if you don't have an agent who's telling you, Andy, you need to get some roles where people see you, dude.
It's probably taken about, 5 minutes to understand why I do it. But, nevertheless, I do go back and do live-action roles. I mean, last year, or it was the year before now, actually, I played, I played Ian Dury, the punk rocker Ian Dury in Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Mm-hmm. And, it was accoladed for that. And I had an amazing time playing that role. I do a lot of, I want to go back and do theatre. There are other live-action roles that I want to play. But I never really draw a distinction between the two. I don't see a difference between playing a performance captured role and a live action role. They're just characters to me at the end of the day, and I'm an actor who wants to explore those characters in fantastically written scripts. And the only caveat is it a good story? Is it a good character?
You mentioned sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and I thought we should listen to one scene of this. This is early in the film. You're playing this punk rocker, Ian Dury. This is early in the film. After a pretty disastrous appearance at a club, a woman played by Naomi Harris approaches, and he kind of romances her. Let's listen.
I thought you were great.
Really? Great as in celebrated? Illustrious, famous, or great as in large, fat, bloated, something you do to a nutmeg, perhaps.
Great as in great. Nice to know. I saw Jimi Hendrix before anyone.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, was Jimmy nice?
He was extremely polite. Said you always wear those glasses.
For your protection, my dear. Oh, I am very, very good with women. I used to live with my mum and her two sisters. I like women so much. I used to think I was a repressed homosexual. But I'm not. Fortuitously, I am gorgeous to look at. Can I tickle your tonsils, please, miss?
Maybe.
Hmm.
You have to be extremely polite.
That's our guest, Andy Serkis, playing Ian Dury in Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Were you particularly drawn to this character? He was a punk rocker, suffered from polio, an interesting character. Were you particularly drawn to him for some reason?
He was a huge hero of mine in the 80s, and I'll never forget, seeing him on television. He wrote incredible songs like Hit Me With a Rhythm Stick and Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. And, I mean, just he was an amazing wordsmith poet, a kind of cabaret stroke vaudevillian performer with a very odd gait and an extraordinary personality. And he combined this with working with a songwriter a music creator called Chaz Jankel, who came with a kind of jazz funk influence. So the combination of these two and the band that he formed called the Blockheads, which I actually got to record with the original band all the songs for the movie, they were the most incredible stage band. It was a cross between sort of weird cabaret and sort of kind of Brechtian out there sort of theater and like I say, vaudeville. His hero was Max Wall, and who was an old British music hall artist, and he just had such an eclectic taste in jazz, and he was an art student, and in many ways, and I actually got to know Ian. He was writing music for a play that I was working on back in the 80s. So he was a huge, huge hero of mine. And in many ways, his kind of eclectic taste reflected mine, and which is I was responsible with the writer for bringing the project together. And we found a producer and a director to work with us. But it came from a real desire to tell his story.
And there was a physical challenge here. He had polio. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you got that side of him physically?
Yeah, I mean, his left-hand side of his body was very, it was deformed and shrunken and very thin. And so I lost 24 pounds, to play the role and built up the right-hand side of my body. I mean, Sophie, his widow, who we got to know his family very well, and, Baxter, it's a father and son movie, Baxter, his son, and Sophie, and Jemima, his daughter, they gave us a lot of personal inside information, and they worked on the script with us. But Sophie, his widow, said, Andy, when you're playing him, you've got to remember, he had the energy of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, a maimed Tyrannosaurus Rex. So when he was on stage, he used to drag the left-hand side of his body around with the force of his right, so he had this huge throbbing muscle in the right-hand side of his neck, and that he powered himself with that right-hand side. So things like that, and he wore a caliper on. He literally lurched around, and in fact, Johnny Rotten in the Sex Pistols based his entire act on Ian Dury's gait.
Well, Andy Serkis, I wish we had more time. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Andy Serkis stars in the new film Rise of the Planet of the Apes with the help of computer graphics. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. With the new film Rise of the Planet of the Apes opening this weekend, we thought you might want to hear about the most famous ape movie of them all, King Kong, which was released in 1933.
What are you going to do?
To build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He has always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
That was Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, the producer who journeys to Skull Island in the Indian Ocean to capture the giant ape and bring him to New York to star in a theater spectacle. There are many things that make King Kong great: the special effects, the image of the giant ape climbing the Empire State Building, Fay Wray's screams, and the score composed by Max Steiner. In 1999, after the soundtrack of the film Dialogue and Music was released on CD, I spoke with film historian Rudy Belmer, who wrote the liner notes. We talked about how the film's director, Marion C. Cooper, used what was then state-of-the-art special effects. Cooper refused to use a man in a gorilla suit for King Kong, and so they went with, the puppet and stop-time animation. Why didn't he want to use a man in a gorilla suit? It certainly would have been a lot easier.
Well, he felt that this had to be something different. And, of course, there'd always been these men running around in gorilla suits in all kinds of movies that were made in the 20s and early 30s. And, that was fine. But he wanted to do something special. And when he saw, over at RKO, Willis O'Brien, who was the chief technician, working on some stop-motion material for a picture called Creation, which was never made, and he saw these dinosaurs, he thought, wait a minute. Nobody's going to finance me during the Depression to go over to Africa and shoot a gorilla and then bring the gorilla to Komodo and so forth and so forth. When he saw that process at RKO, he thought, wait a minute, this is the way to do King Kong. So he wanted to do it via this stop motion, but to hedge his bet, he also had a huge full-size bust of Kong constructed and a hand and arm of Kong constructed, and a foot, so that for some shots, for example, when he's holding Fay Wray in his hand, you've got the hand. When you see an occasional close-up of the head, it's this big, oversized Kong. But he did not want to shoot a man in a gorilla suit. He just drew the line right there.
I've always thought that Kong's size and his, relative size to buildings and people keeps changing throughout the movie.
You're absolutely right on that, Terry. It does keep changing. And this, once again, was people were saying, well, wait a minute. We built him on a scale of 18 inches to a foot, meaning that he'd be 18 feet high. Yet you want to make him, he said, I want to make him, for this scene, I want to make him bigger. I want to make him 24. And they all kind of looked at him like, I want to make him 24 feet. And then on occasion he said, forget the 18, the 24. I want to make him 45. So it does keep changing. But he felt that the concept, when he got to New York, he definitely had to be bigger because of the environment. And, of course, Cooper was right. Cooper had to, you know, do a lot of fighting for things that he believed in, but inevitably, I found through the years, he was right.
Now, King Kong is really filled with a lot of bondage imagery, you know, Fay Wray and flimsy chiffon dresses and lingerie,
yes,
tied at the stake on the island or pulled out of her bed by Kong's giant arm in New York. Do you think that Cooper was intentionally playing to a kind of low-level bondage S&M kind of thing?
I don't think so. I think that he just thought this would be great material. You know, I don't think he ever gave thought to that sort of thing. He obviously wanted to use a woman, and he had not used a woman, really, in his documentaries. But he did want to use, and he did like Fay Wray. He had used her in Four Feathers, the Cooper Shudsack production of 29, and he used her in The Most Dangerous Game, which is a wonderful short story by Richard Connell that he was producing concurrently with King Kong at RKO. She was in that, and she was running around in the same jungle that she'd be shooting in the jungle during the day for The Most Dangerous Game and at night with Cooper for King Kong. And for King Kong, he wanted her in a blonde wig. She was actually a brunette, which she appears to be in The Most Dangerous Game. But he thought that the Beauty and the Beast bit, that the beauty should be a blonde. So she wore a blonde wig. And he was great friends with her and admired her, and they remained friends over the years.
What would you say the importance of Max Steiner's score is for King Kong? I mean, I love the score, but I find something very amusing about it, which is that although it's set on this island, Skull Island, the music is really very European and nothing like what would have been heard in the region at that time. And I'll play this scene in a moment, but, you know, when they first get to the island, when the American film crew first gets to the island and they're mm-hmm. watching this, you know, native ritual.
Yes.
The natives are chanting Kong, Kong, Kong. And there's this like march behind them as a kind of precursor of Kong's footsteps that will be marching toward,
yes,
toward his prey. And the march is a very European form, and the brass instruments playing it are so European. And yet this defines a kind of, you know, South Sea Island or African kind of Hollywood sound.
That's true. Well, of course, Max and everybody else associated with this picture knew we were dealing with a fantasy here. It's a total fantasy. A more, as Cooper said, a more illogical picture could never have been thought up. And it is illogical if you stop and examine it from that standpoint. But the music, you know, they weren't saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get something that's indigenous to this area. We have to be authentic. We have to be like a documentary. And, you know, it was full reign of the imagination. And, of course, Max composed in a full Wagnerian manner, you know, with leitmotifs and with all kinds of percussive effects that could be used. And he just went all out. And the aspect of credibility, you forget about that because, once again, we're dealing in the world of fantasy, the ultimate world of fantasy.
Well, let's hear that scene where the film crew is observing this native ritual where the natives are chanting Kong.
What do you suppose is happening?
Oh, they're up to some of their heathen tricks. But don't go rushing out to sea.
All right, but isn't it exciting?
Sure. I wish we'd left you on the ship.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Wait, easy now. Wait till I see what goes on.
A show. Hey, Skipper, come here and get a load of this. Ever see anything like that before in your life?
Pure musical delirium. really
and
it.
frenzy yeah, and delirium. Yeah. I think that would be a good team.
Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, he says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream, and he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which, of course, she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams. So fortunately, she had one major screaming session, which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course, King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, he was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which, of course, is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course, you can do all kinds of things.
Film historian Rudy Belmer, recorded in 1999. Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, the duo behind Fountains of Wayne, just released their first new album since 2007. Sky Full of Holes showcases the detailed storytelling and bright melodies that rock critic Ken Tucker says can occasionally hide darker thoughts.
There's a dreamy summer breeze wafting through much of Sky Full of Holes, as though Fountains of Wayne wanted to make the new album sync up with the season. And just as this summer has been hotter than many recent ones, there's also a warm intensity to some of the songs, such as the album's first single, Someone's Gonna Break Your Heart. The 13 songs on Sky Full of Holes are pretty consistent pleasures in the manner we've come to expect from Fountains of Wayne. Precisely worded, catchy songs about small moments in life that can be breezy and witty, as well as breezy, witty, and poignant. Their biggest hit, 2003's Stacy's Mom, a winking foray into broad humor, holds the same place in Fountains of Wayne's career as Dead Skunk does in Loudon Wainwright III's, or as Short People did in Randy Newman's. A fluke for which there's no reason to try and replicate, and thus the musicians went back to their more clever business. Like this song, Richie and Reuben, about a couple of on-the-make entrepreneurs who aren't nearly as smart as they think they are.
They opened up a bar called Living Hell.
could say that Richie and Reuben is Fountain of Wayne's Steely Dan song, cynical about subjects that merit cynicism, presenting a narrator who thinks he's tough-minded but might be one of the suckers that Richie and Reuben have scammed in the past. One of the prettiest songs on the album is A Road Song, about a guy in a rock band on tour who's missing his loved one so much he's writing her a song. Its beauty is enhanced by the precision of its meter and rhyme.
We're still in Wisconsin, as far as I know. Today was Green Bay and tomorrow Chicago. Wish I was lying, but there isn't much to report. My phone is dying, so I've got to keep it short. I just wanted to say, hey, I've been writing you a road song. It's a cliche, but hey, that doesn't make it so wrong. And in between the stops at the Cracker Barrel and 40 movies with Will Ferrell, I need some way to occupy my time. So I'm writing you a road song. I sure hope you don't mind.
At one point in that song, Fountains of Wayne sings, I bought you a light blue t-shirt last night from some band I couldn't stand, but their logo's all right. That couplet is wry and sweet, and I admire the little internal rhyme of light and night in the first line. But what clinches its fineness is the way it captures something that happens in everyday life but is rarely noted. People do make purchases such as a souvenir t-shirt just because it looks good. It's not exactly an ironic buy, but it's close. More overt is the wistful sarcasm a bit later, when the narrator describes his road song by singing, I know it's not what you'd call necessary, and I know that I'm no Steve Perry. For Fountains of Wayne fans, Journey is definitely an irony inducer. Fountains of Wayne is loath to make music cast as grand tragedy or melodrama, but at least a couple of times here, Collingwood and Schlesinger capture a mood of quiet despair in the songs Action Hero, about a hapless suburban dad, and this song, Hate to See You Like This, in which the narrator tries to cajole a young woman out of her listless depression. Fountains of Wayne is without doubt the finest contemporary pop rock band in America. And that and 99 cents will get you a Lady Gaga download. Collingwood and Schlesinger occasionally pursue separate projects. Collingwood, who likes country music, reportedly has a solo album in the works, while Schlesinger has continued his interest in Broadway by co-writing the opening song on this past year's Tony Awards, It's Not Just for Gays Anymore, performed by host Neil Patrick Harris. And jolly good for them, as long as it means the twosome will continue to regroup for more refreshed Fountains of Wayne-ness.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Sky Full of Holes from Fountains of Wayne. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.